Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 699, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program is being recorded on December 27th of the year 2009. We're going to plunge right in where we left off at the end of Side 1, and again, please use the SpitfireList.com website to flesh out your understanding. This broadcast will exemplify those programs for which an understanding or a use of the SpitfireList.com is essential for a fundamental understanding. We've been talking about the U.S. basically in terms of a metaphor of a hijacked airplane with underground Reich elements essentially piloting this country, or what's left of it at this point, in a direction that not only isn't going to benefit this country, but is going to benefit in the short run the underground Reich, and which is going to lead to not only the disintegration of this country, but possibly conflicts between this and other societies. I've been talking about the UNPO, which to all appearances is an underground Reich entity, and its links with secessionist groups in the United States. It also is looking to break up Russia and China. We've spoken about that in the past, and it has been active in the Balkans. We're going to talk more about some of the groups here in the United States that have been targeted by the UNPO. I simply want to note in passing here, before we focus briefly on Russia and the Caucasus, I want to note that some of the areas being championed by the UNPO or groups affiliated with the UNPO, such as the AIP, are looking to, among other things, instigate the secession of Hawaii from the United States. I would note that that would seriously impact America's strategic position in the Pacific. They also are looking to promote the secession of Alaska. That would not only further weaken America's position in the Pacific, it also would weaken America's position vis-a-vis the Arctic, and it would deprive the United States of a major source of fossil fuels. They also, the UNPO, that is, has been championing the independence of the Lakota and the area that has been essentially identified by the Lakota as their homeland, and they are openly secessionist, elements of them anyway, just happens to coincide with the Bakken field, which is a major source of petroleum in the future. I believe it's oil shale, but that has enormous implications for the future of America's energy situation. Remove those elements and you basically are well along towards dismembering the United States and ultimately re-colonializing the United States, not in a formal political sense, not in the formal sense that it would become a colony of Germany or the United Kingdom or any other country, but in terms of corporate management, the United States is going to be divided up into smaller entities which will be controlled by powerful corporations, in turn dominated by the underground Reich. There was a very interesting story that was carried by Reuters, and there was an interesting press conference or dissertation given by Ramzan Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya. He is basically a Kremlin functionary, a former Islamist, and to all appearances is handling Chechnya with a very, very hard hand indeed, or heavy hand indeed. So I don't want what I'm about to say to be misunderstood as advocating some of the brutal tactics that appear to have been employed against critics of the government in Chechnya and others. One also wonders to what extent some of these critics have been the unwitting tools of elements like the UNPO and others. But interestingly enough, in a recent press conference, Ramzan Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya and a Kremlin tool, identified correctly, in my opinion, agitation by the West as having much to do with the continued social unrest in the Caucasus. Of course, the Caucasus has a great deal to do with, surprise, surprise, fossil fuels. That's one of the major areas of Russian and former Soviet petroleum production. Xinjiang province, where the Uyghurs are basically agitating for independence, also has enormous natural resources, including, surprise, surprise, petroleum, like the area that is being claimed by the Lakota, like Alaska. So when you begin looking at the UNPO and the wonderful little groups whose independence they're championing, just happens to, for the most part, to be groups that are involved with one or another very strategic aspect of the world and whose independence would benefit those who would like to gain control of that. And this actually is a relatively old colonial strategy. It's just that whereas people have been accustomed, and you know, to a considerable extent correctly so, to talking about U.S. imperialism, what never occurred to them is maybe the U.S. is going to be broken up and recolonialized in the wake of the end of the Cold War. It's also important to understand that the U.S. is very much like a hijacked plane, and underground Reich elements associated with the UNPO, the former anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, people like Paula Dobryansky, daughter of Lev Dobryansky, Paula Dobryansky heading the Tibetan desk at the State Department. These are elements that are piloting the U.S. plane. It is being used to further the foreign policy and strategic goals of the underground Reich, to the great detriment and ultimate destruction of the United States. Quite correctly, Ramzan Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya, has identified the unrest in the Caucasus as being basically instigated in many ways by the West. I would note in this regard that there's abundant evidence that Islamists are basically being handled in a way that is not in some ways unlike the fascist powers of World War II. Many members of the American financial and industrial elite were economically and politically allied with the fascist powers of World War II, and even as our fighting men and women were engaged in a very real struggle against the armies of the fascist powers, members of our political and economic elite were allied with America's enemies. Something very similar is happening with regard to the Islamists, where on the one hand there is a very real war against them, with very real casualties, and yet the American elite, epitomized by the Bush administration and its Saudi and petroleum links, is also working with the Islamists in areas like the former Balkans, where Islamists were used by the West to help break up first Yugoslavia and then Serbia. And there are indications, too, that there are elements of the West that are supporting the unrest in the Caucasus. Reuters' story about that on December 21st of 2009, it's headlined, "Chechen President Says the West Wants to Destroy Russia." And again, I agree with his analysis here, not to be understood as an endorsement of the policies of Ramzan Kadyrov. The article is by Michael Stott and Olga Petrova. It reads in part, "Ramzan Kadyrov, a 33-year-old former rebel-turned-Kremlin loyalist, said that last year's attack by Georgia, which is a U.S. ally in the pro-Russian rebel region of South Ossetia, was part of a Western plot to seize the whole Caucasus region. Quote, "If they get control of the Caucasus, you could say they'll get control of virtually all of Russia, because the Caucasus is our backbone," Kadyrov said. This conversation was conducted at his exotic private offices near the town of Guderms outside the Chechen capital, Grozny. The complex features a zoo, a racehorse for his horses, two large golden lions guarding the entrance, and an artificial mountain lit up in different colors at night. "The Russian government needs to work out a strategy. It needs to attack," the Chechen president said. "Georgia, South Ossetia, Ukraine, all this will go on and on. It's Russia's private affliction. Why should we always suffer if we can eradicate this for good? We are a great power. We have everything, an army and technology. We need to attack," unquote. And he goes on to describe some of the background of Mr. Kadyrov, whose father was at one point one of the rebels looking to establish Chechen independence and eventually switched sides. And speaking about the rebels against whom he has now been campaigning, and apparently using a very heavy hand, "Today there are very few rebels left," Kadyrov said. "This year we destroyed a great many terrorists in the neighboring Russian republics of Ingushetia, Dagestan, and Chechnya." Asked how many remained, Kadyrov replied, "If I knew how many and where, I would have destroyed them a long time ago." Kadyrov said the remaining rebels were kept going by Western money and guns. "The West is financing them," he said. "I officially declare this. Those who destroyed the Soviet Union, those who want to destroy the Russian Federation, they stand behind them," unquote. U.S. President Barack Obama has offered to reset relations with Russia after a tense period during the presidency of George W. Bush, and Kadyrov said it would be good for Washington if the United States followed more friendly policies toward Russia. Well, indeed, rollback or liberation theory, which sought to break up the Soviet Union, was successfully manifested by the United States during the latter phase of the Cold War. It was a Third Reich political and strategic strategy, and it was put into effect under the Reagan administration, whose heritage I have described in Side 1. even, yea, verily, as we speak. The same forces. Now, in the West here, one automatically thinks the United States, and certainly there are American elements involved with this, but the United States itself faces a similar fate, barring a sea change. The United States itself is going to become the victim of rollback or liberation theory. That might seem a bit far-fetched, but in the event of an economic collapse, a very real possibility and a certainty in the event of a terrorist incident using weapons of mass destruction, I would not be too surprised to see the United States break up rather like the former Soviet Union did. One should not lose sight of the fact that the Caucasus is a major area of petroleum and natural gas production for Russia. And when one examines the UNPO and the areas that are the focal point of agitation by these underground Reich ethnic elements, they very often coincide, as I've indicated, with strategic centers, including and especially centers of fossil fuel production as well. Paula Dobryansky, the aforementioned Paula Dobryansky, who heads up the Tibet desk at the State Department, is the daughter of Lev Dobryansky. By the way, Paula Dobryansky has perhaps been replaced by a Barack Obama. I'm not sure. Going into Obama's administration, she was the head of the Tibet desk at the State Department. Her father, Lev Dobryansky, was part of the Ukrainian fascists allied with the OUNB. And indeed, the head of the OUNB, a Ukrainian separatist and fascist organization that not only participated in the Waffen-SS campaigns on the Eastern Front, but also in the liquidation of Jews and other groups. The OUNB became a major element of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a major element of the Reagan administration. The eventual head of the OUNB in America, a woman named Ekaterina Tymoshenko, was the head of presidential liaison for the White House under Ronald Reagan. She then moved on. I guess she liked working in executive mansions because ultimately she married Mr. Yushchenko. She's now known as Ekaterina Yushchenko, and Mr. Yushchenko's party is manifesting all of the old fascist and anti-Semitic characteristics of the OUNB. And it is that element that I believe Kadyrov is correctly identifying here, an element that very much does want to break up Russia. They want to get their hands on those fossil fuels. They want to further weaken this very large and potentially very powerful country. And these are indeed the elements who destroyed the Soviet Union. What Mr. Kadyrov probably is not aware of is the fact that they also want to break up China, and they seek the destruction of the United States itself. So note Mr. Kadyrov's interview. Again, my endorsement of his analysis should not in any way be misunderstood as an endorsement for his tactics. A fascinating story about Germany's attitude toward potential U.S. A tightening of U.S. relations with China was carried by the GermanForeignPolicy.com website. This particular article is titled Fear of Demotion. It was carried by the GermanForeignPolicy.com website of July 16th of 2009. The article reads, EU political strategists are alarmed by U.S. proposals for a closer cooperation between the USA and the People's Republic of China. According to the EU think tank, European Council on Foreign Relations, fears are, quote, are revived, again quoting, within Europe that it could be sidelined in a new world order, unquote. These fears are fomented by proposals by the former U.S. presidential advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, for regular, informal U.S.-Chinese consultations on important global issues. Brzezinski would like to see this cooperation between Washington and Beijing at the same level as the meetings of the eight most significant industrial nations, or G8, dubbing it G2 or the Group of Two. The apparent global balance of power shift from the Atlantic to the Pacific is heightening the tone in anti-Chinese agitation that has always been quite harsh in Berlin. This agitation found its latest expression in the Xinjiang campaign, the EU's and Germany's reaction to the Uyghur massacre of nearly 140 non-Uyghur Chinese. This campaign is directed toward weakening the Chinese rival in its strategically important Western regions, thereby impeding China's further rise. The current debate is taking place in the context of the People's Republic of China's steady advance. China is playing an important role in the struggle against the economic crisis because it holds, quote, the largest monetary reserves worldwide, unquote, assesses U.S. billionaire George Soros. Again quoting, China's decisions will have an effect on the future of the world's economy to the same extent as President Obama's, unquote. The People's Republic of China has become too powerful too soon, in the opinion of some. The German EU think tank, the European Council on Foreign Relations, is also pointing to China's rapidly growing importance. Particularly, the USA is financially dependent on China, and Chinese support is also needed to influence the Iranian nuclear program. China could not only use its veto power in the UN Security Council, but also its exclusive economic influence to intervene on the ground. And, lastly, the Afghan-Pakistani war zone borders on China, therefore necessitating joint action. Because China's ascension no longer can be ignored, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, has submitted a proposal on the future relationship with China already last January. In the 1970s, Brzezinski had played a leading role in the rapprochement between China and the USA, striking a serious blow against the Soviet Union. Brzezinski now explains that the fact that the USA today is largely depending on the People's Republic makes a corresponding institutionalization of the cooperation between the two countries absolutely necessary. It no longer suffices to hold consultations within the framework of larger multinational meetings, G14, G16, or G20. The top leaders of both states should, quote, therefore meet informally on a regular schedule for personal in-depth discussions, unquote, not only about bilateral issues, but also about, quote, the world in general, unquote. Borrowing from the example of the conferences of the eight largest industrial countries, Brzezinski promotes a G2 or a group of two. Though very controversial with many opponents inside the USA, Brzezinski's proposal provoked serious concerns in Europe. The former U.S. presidential advisor conceives of the G2 as being on a par with the U.S.-European and U.S.-Japanese relations. But one can imagine that with China's rapid growth and influence, the G2 could in the long run play a decisive role. The prospect that the most focal global issues could no longer be regulated at a transatlantic but a trans-Pacific level is setting off alarms in European capitals. The prospect of G2, ECFR writes, again quoting, revives fears within Europe that it could be sidelined in a new world order that exploits its weaknesses, unquote. ECFR does not expect an imminent implementation of G2. Quote, no one in the Obama administration has yet used the term, and it is seldom even mentioned in China. But the basic apprehension is obviously there. Berlin would particularly be hit by Chinese-U.S. consultations. Special methods of German foreign policy always included positioning itself between opposing powers as, quote, mediator, unquote, and making deals with one or the other side, a seesaw policy practiced exemplary in Germany's relations to Russia and the United States. If the United States and the People's Republic of China would establish a cooperation framework, Germany could no longer play this role in relation to the coming decade's two central powers. For years, Berlin has been contemplating this possibility. The German government is therefore particularly interested to thwart regular consultations between Washington and Beijing. Now, here again, the concept of the hijacked U.S. as a hijacked airplane with a foreign policy that will not only ultimately destroy the U.S., but is aimed at partitioning or greatly weakening Russia and China, perhaps also eventually provoking a reaction against the U.S. so that would further its destruction. But the metaphor of the hijacked airplane, and bear in mind Paula Dobriansky's position at the Tibet desk and her Ukrainian fascist heritage, perhaps this metaphor is most clearly viewed in connection with the campaigns against China. And again, I've done a lot of work on the Uyghurs, on the Tibetans, and on the UNPO. Please use the Spitfire website to enhance your understanding. The article concludes about the Xinjiang campaign in which the Muslim Uyghurs, championed by the Muslim Brotherhood, were basically instigated. They're also championed, by the way, by the Dalai Lama. They massacred 140 non-Uyghur Chinese. The last part of the article concludes, the apparent global balance of power shift from the Atlantic to the Pacific has already been heightening the tone in traditional anti-Chinese agitation. This agitation finds its latest expression, the Xinjiang campaign initiated in the West in the aftermath of the Uyghur massacre of nearly 140 non-Uyghur Chinese. This campaign, blaming the Chinese security forces for the massacre rather than the Uyghur culprits, is patterned after last year's Tibet campaign, both in being aimed at Beijing and in the use of falsifications and classical propaganda techniques. This campaign is aimed at weakening the Chinese rival in its strategically important Western regions. At the same time, it is strengthening anti-Chinese forces in the USA involved in the subversive activities in Xinjiang as well as in Tibet, a coincidental and welcomed contribution toward thwarting special U.S.-Chinese consultations a la G2. Well, the Dalai Lama, as we've seen in the past, not only a longtime operative on behalf of the worst elements of the Central Intelligence Agency, tutored by an SS officer, the exemplar of an utterly barbaric society for all of the heavy-handedness of China in Tibet. The Tibetan people are far better off under Chinese stewardship than they were under the Lamas. Basically, it was a slave-holding society. And one of the Dalai Lama's close personal associates was an SS war criminal named Bruno Breguet, who was the SS anthropologist on the initial SS mission to Tibet in the 1930s. He later toured one of the concentration camps and selected some 130-some-odd Asiatic types from among Russian POWs or Soviet POWs, who were then promptly killed for a subsequent dissection by Bruno Breguet. He's one of the Dalai Lama's close associates and associated with the Tibetan government in exile. And that, I think, as much as anything, indicates what a complete lie the entire Dalai Lama's trip is. I don't like using terms like that. It's basically what the guy is. The Dalai Lama and his whole operation, everything about him, is just a great big stinking lie. A brief digression here, perhaps not a digression, but China has been catching a lot of heat in connection with the recently concluded Copenhagen conference. Perhaps accurately, that's not something I was able to follow that closely. The one thing I found very interesting about the Copenhagen conference is that the European Parliament, bear in mind Europe's anxieties about China, the European Parliament was represented at Copenhagen by Nick Griffin. Nick Griffin is the head of the British National Party. That's the top British fascist party. It'd be kind of like having David Duke head up the American contingent to Copenhagen. It's quite remarkable, and what role he might have played in some of this is a matter of speculation. The British Guardian carried this article, and this is from The Observer. It's a Guardian article, but originally carried by The Observer of November 29th of 2009, article by Toby Helm, headlined, "Climate Change Denier Nick Griffin to Represent EU at Copenhagen." It reads in part, "Nick Griffin, the leader of the British National Party, is to represent the European Parliament at the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, which opens next week. Last night, politicians and scientists reacted furiously to news that the far-right politician and climate change denier should be attending the summit on behalf of the EU. Griffin, who was elected to the European Parliament in June, confirmed last night that he would attend as the representative of the Parliament's Environment Committee. What role he might have played, again, is obviously a matter of speculation. But what we're going to do, we're going to conclude the broadcast with a partial reading of an article that contains some potentially optimistic considerations, but overall, I think, assesses the American economy and the potential for further disaster and a breakup. The following article by Peter Salalis, a former Australian financial analyst, is called "One Generation to Regeneration." The URL for the article will be in the description to the website. It's from November 24th of 2009. "I dare say that everyone between the ages of 25 and death is living with regrets about the past, anxieties about the future, or both. The current financial crisis is much like a health crisis in that it has triggered a complex array of responses of mind, body, and soul, whereby no one is immune, whether wealthy or poor, single or married, employed or unemployed. Some years ago, when I was still practicing as an accountant, I noted that people retiring with a lump of money in the bank would gradually go from relative comfort to measured existence. Their adult children, in the meantime, had become enthralled with the use of debt as a means of leveraging financial outcomes while bankrolling their lifestyles largely on capital gains. As for the grandchildren, they were raised with tutors and coaches to enter business schools and law schools or golfing and tennis academies while being fed and entertained, but not much else. As we all know, the gates to this paradise are now closing. On the other side, where the grass was not so green and decidedly patchy, it became increasingly apparent that the welfare state was to be every individual's guardian angel from womb to the tomb. It would attempt to cure ills through handouts and programs designed to minimize misery, but not to maximize and realize potential. This group is now growing largely as a result of job losses. The above descriptions do not, of course, fully encompass the whole array of familial experiences, but are nevertheless indicative of a great many families to one extent or another across the Western world. This corrosive financial crisis has exposed both the haves and have-nots to the realities of a badly wounded and badly run financial system, which can no longer deliver either capital gains or handouts at a pace commensurate with the population's expectations and needs. The drying up of credit completes the shrinkage of consumption. For those in their twilight years, the decimation of their retirement nest egg through a collapsed stock market and miserly rates of interest on their certificates of deposit is especially of concern, as there is neither sufficient time for nor promising enough signs of a meaningful turnaround. Those in the middle years have regretted much of their past lifestyles and investment choices and are now largely hamstrung as to how to proceed, as job losses and capital destruction have left them dazed and often without a home. What is government doing, you may ask? First of all, one must ask, where has the government been? The answer is where it has always been, in the hands of powerful business interests that this time went too far, unquote. This control, of course, is nothing new or necessarily bad in the history of mankind. Powerful, however, should not preclude enlightened, and this is what has been missing in the lead-up to the downturn and since the downturn. The federal government reminds me of a fire chief who recruits firemen from among a group of arsonists to fight the blaze of the century. The arsonist banks have gladly seconded their chosen sons, Henry Paulson, Timothy Geithner, and Larry Summers, among others, to act as firemen in the service of their nation. It was these banks, with their campaign contributions, jobs for the boys, and coteries of lobbyists and ratings agencies, that enabled either the repeal of safeguards such as the Glass-Steagall Act or the flagrant abuse of lending policies in the belief that a rising market would conceal and overcome the unsustainable banking and business practices they pursued. Then, after further discussion of the potential for economic catastrophe in this country, skipping down, in view of all of this, the almost improbable scenarios painted by Russian academic Igor Panarin of a U.S. collapse and disintegration will become increasingly tenable if unemployment, home foreclosures, and bank failures continue. The U.S. population is armed, and the increase in the number of vigilante groups has the potential to at least make headlines. Think about Norm Olson and the AIP. Continuing, the catalyst for a domino effect of events is never seriously expected, and the possibility of martial law in the land of the free requires only a solemn-looking president to announce it. Beware, however, as the seemingly catatonic populace starts to rebel. And he goes on to describe what might happen. The article is not entirely pessimistic, but it will be posted in its entirety, accessed in its entirety, in the description for the Record program number 699. However, this concludes For the Record 699. Please consider these possibilities. For this wraps up this broadcast. This is being recorded on December 27th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Happy New Year.